This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Today, what we're going to be talking about is expectations and how it plays a role with motivation. Now, I mean, I grew up watching movies, and the line with movies is always, you can do anything you want, you can be anything that you want, all you have to do is work hard enough, and you can basically achieve anything. And when I was growing up, I was a bit of a smart aleck, and I was, well, I can't exactly jump to the moon if I wanted to, no matter how hard I work. Or I'll never be able to dunk a basketball because I'm maybe not tall enough, or maybe I'm not going to ever going to have it as somebody who's really tall. So we're going to be talking about this idea of expectations and motivation and whether or not they go hand in hand. Dr. Yes, Lowdy, what do you have to say on that?
Well, the expectations and motivation absolutely do go hand in hand, Nate. It's exactly what you're thinking. And the relationship between those two things is profound and extremely important for people's well-being. The sort of subtext in our culture is that people believe that they believe all kinds of, or I would say semi-believe, all kinds of ridiculous notions, like, for example, if you believe in yourself enough, you can do anything, or that anybody can be anything. And this is obviously ridiculous. However, there's little threads of truth in it, but the problem is that those kinds of concepts will actually wind up putting pressure on people in ways that is often not really productive for them and counter to what's in their best interest for feeling good about themselves. The fundamental problem with having expectations very high, it seems like this is a very benign, pleasant thing to do and very encouraging thing to do, for example, with parents to children, to tell children that they can become anything and do anything. I don't see any really problem with this when we're talking about a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old that really, you know, doesn't have any concept of what it is they're looking at. But when we start talking about people that are a little bit older, 12-year-old, 14-year-old, et cetera, this starts to confuse them in the following way, and that is that they can see that what you're saying is not true, and yet you are essentially putting expectations on them that they can't meet. So one way this will play out is often parents will have very high expectations for their children with respect to grades. And they will, if a child does well in a given semester, so if parents have high expectations for children that are a bit above their abilities, let's say you've got a bright child, and the parents in one semester of their life, they actually get straight A's. This is, I'm not just sort of talking out of bounds here, this is actually a fairly common kind of occurrence that I've seen several times in my clinical practice over the years. So you may have someone who has done something, had quite an excellent outcome at one point, and maybe a straight A semester or a year. And then what the parents will then do is tell the child they're a straight-A student and tell everybody in hearing that they're a straight-A student. And now what happens is the expectation is that if they really work hard that they can achieve this. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's very likely that it is not true. And so what will happen is that the child is put in a bind, that if they work hard, they're going to fall short of expectations, and therefore they're going to be a disappointment. And if they work hard and manage to meet the expectations, nothing special has really happened. But all they've done is meet expectations. And so this is actually what seems, from the parent's point of view, as a very benign, encouraging strategy for talking to their kids about their goals, winds up actually being pretty brutal and putting the kids in a bind that they're in essentially almost in a no-win situation.
That's so does the kid compute all this in their heads consciously, or what's the process there?
Yeah, this is actually the kid is actually running a very sophisticated cost-benefit analysis that will result in them generally not trying very hard at all, and very often making a concerted display of not trying and possibly flunking out, at least in selected classes. So let me explain why this is, why there's a counterproductive, what I call kick over the table, anti-motivation. This is a very interesting characteristic of human beings, which you're not going to see throughout the animal kingdom. It's really specific to us. Let me describe why we have this and how such tendencies would have evolved. Think back. If you were to go to an ancient Stone Age situation where you had a young man that was, say, 16, 17 years old, and he was had been observed by the village to be sort of an average hunter, average athlete. So and let's suppose he was average attractive. So he would have been seen as average mating material by the young women of his generation. So they would have pegged him for the middle of the bell curve of the 10 young men in the village. He would have been ranked at number 5, more or less. That's, he was gonna struggle with those parameters for the rest of his life, of course. Now, however, let's suppose he goes out on his very first hunt, and he comes across with a wildebeest with its foot stuck in a snake hole, and he bludgeons it over the head and drags it home, and there's a big feast, and now everybody is thinking that they have missed a bet on this guy, that he actually has a lot more chops than anybody thought. And so what's going to happen now, and of course he's not going to tell them the true story of what actually happened. He'll tell some fancy story about how the saber-toothed cat was on his left and a lion on the right, and how he maneuvered brilliantly the situation to get the wildebeest. So anyway, the upshot of this is that he will actually have more what I call esteem or more status than he deserves. So his rating in the village just went from a 5 to a 7. He just went up the dominance hierarchy in terms of his heterosexual attractiveness and his general esteem in the village.
Wait,
now,
so
this is.
So are you suggesting that young men are willing to lie just to get some sex? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, young men are willing to lie to get some sex. They're willing to exaggerate.
I'm so glad we had this show that we could figure this out.
Yes, that's good. Believe it or not, now I, of course, have never done such a thing myself. But I,
oh, no.
Apparently it has a... It has
it's a, only it the has Stone happened. Age ancestors that did that.
Thank God some of my Stone Age ancestors did this, so they got some sex so that I'm here, because otherwise I wouldn't have made it.
So does that now, mean that this kid, that this younger kid, if he doesn't engage in that type of manipulation, he's not going to be able to pass on his genes in the way he wants? Is that that's what I'm understanding from that.
Yes, well, that would be true. In other words, he's under sexual competition, so he is being slated for the middle of the bell curve. That's what's going to happen. All of us are sort of kicking and screaming to try to get up higher in the food chain with respect to the genes that are appealing for sexual reproduction. So that's the nature of all animal life. That's what animals are actually doing. Now, we start figuring this out in the first grade at Valentine's Day. So I don't remember first grade, but I very clearly remember second grade Valentine's Day, because the teacher put these little envelopes with our names on them at the front of the room, and all the kids would drop their Valentines in the envelopes of the different kids. And there was some of us that got a lot more than others. I got like a nice solid average amount. But I remember a girl named Kim that was the real looker in the class. Hers was full. Okay. And it was
Yeah. See, I remember my second grade Valentine's also. And I didn't know what to do. You know, it was second grade. So I asked my dad. My dad said, "Well, we're going to sit down. We're going to make Valentine's to all the girls in the class and then see which one reciprocates."
That's a great strategy.
So we sat down and wrote, I remember, little hearts and all this other stuff.
Yeah. Good. That was, your dad was a good salesman.
That's why I'm here.
There you go. That's why you're here. You sold somebody. You got it. That's beautiful, mate. So this is what happens. We are, from the time we're at about the second grade, you come out of the ether of young life and you realize, oh boy, there's a competition here. And you didn't ask to have the competition. You're just stuck with it. And you're on a treadmill that there's no stopping. And this is just how life is. And what's happening is, on the other side of the fence, the opposite sex is observing and cataloging and rating. And on our side of the fence, we are observing and cataloging and rating. And everybody's grandstanding for all they're worth to try to get what I call the magic 10%, which are going to try to go up 10% in the food chain in order to get slightly better genes than you're giving. So this is a great, big, monstrous poker game. It's actually what it is. And I have a name for this thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, yeah, you can say something intelligent after I'm done. So I call this...
unlikely.
I call this the Darwin Derby, okay? So it's just a race that goes absolutely nowhere. You just spin around the track, and it starts all over again the next generation. And then they race around the track as fast as they can. And then they go to the next generation. All that's happening is the genes are jumping from one old lame horse to the next. And so that's your lot in life, your job is to actually what I call win your heat in the Darwin Derby. Your job is to try to pull a little bit ahead of where it is that you were before, to try to grab a little bit of fancier genes than you had, that you came into the earth with. And so in doing so, you are statistically increasing the likelihood that your genes will be on the planet 1,000 years from now. And so, of course, no organism has the slightest conceptual insight into this, including essentially zero humans know this. But this is, in fact, how nature works, and we are thrust into this mess whether we want to be in it or not, and we are trying to win our heat in the Darwin Derby. And so this kid, this 17-year-old kid in the Stone Age, his job is to win his heat in the Darwin Derby. And so he's trying to go up the food chain. Now, he's not going to get the 10, and he's not going to get the 9, and he's almost certainly not going to get the 8. But the 7 might be in range if she believes that he's actually a latent little superstar that has great hunting abilities. So that's why he is in no rush to get clear with the village about what really happened on this hunt. So this extra aura that he has over him, his job is to try to keep that aura for as long as he can. So this is now critical. If human beings were honest and straightforward about their genetic benefits and costs that they would bring to relationships, then dating would look rather funny. People would come in with no makeup, plain, tightly fitting clothes, and they would sit down, and the guy would bring his portfolio of his investments, and the girl would bring her driver's license that shows her true age, and her true hair color. And,
there would be an honest vetting of the gene quality of everybody that's involved. And instead, what's happening is everybody's out there bluffing and grandstanding and hiding their liabilities and emphasizing their assets. It's essentially like selling potato chips. That potato chip bag, they give a great big bag with half a bag of potato chips, and they have to because the competitors are doing exactly the same thing, one bag of potato chips over. And so the same thing is happening in the dating arena. Everybody's pushing hard to try to oversell the genes that they are selling by a reasonable margin so that it isn't obviously ridiculous, but you're trying to more than put your best foot forward. Everything that you put forward is the best that you can figure out how to do it.
That sure explains I should stop wearing Speedos on my dates. this makes a lot of sense to me, but what do you say to people who say, Dr. Lyle, this sounds pretty cynical and a bit depressing when you think about it like this?
Well, I suppose one could be cynical and depressed about it, but the truth is, it just sort of is what it is. We are used to it, all of us, and it's no more cynical than looking at the free market and realizing that every company is trying to outwit the other companies, and that when they advertise, they are almost certainly over-advertising. So, I mean, I don't know what car that you can look at an ad for that didn't win some fancy award that is being, narrated by some narrator with a golden set of pipes in his head that sounds beautiful, and we get this feeling that this car is this fantastic car. Well, no more fantastic than the seven other models that it's competing with. But this is marketing. Marketing is all about trying to get in principle. If you think about it, no manufacturer has any in principle edge over any other manufacturer. So anything that you can do, I can do just as well. I just have to find out how you do it and copy it. So really, it's about marketing. And so when it comes to the mating game in humanity or throughout nature, what you see is very, very intensive efforts at marketing. And in fact, if you go into the woods and what you hear is a bunch of noise from all the animals in the woods, essentially the only noise you're hearing is males screaming in the forest that I have the best genes mate with me. That is what it is that you're hearing in the village, in the forest. And that is effectively when you're listening to human conversation, particularly males talking to females that they're attracted to, that's more or less what they're saying. No matter what the actual words are, that's what's going on.
Hmm. That explains why I got kicked out of the nightclub over the weekend, because I went in there and I screamed, I have the best genes mate with me. And all the girls looked at me and said, what are you doing here?
And the bouncer,
why are you wearing a Speedo?
That's very
but anyway,
good. Okay.
So this kid gets the wildebeest all so that he can get mating rights to the higher quality females.
That's correct.
And would that make him so then what happens?
Okay, now let's look what happens, because it's fascinating. What happens is that he's uncomfortable because he knows that he's getting more credit than he deserves. And so he knows that he will be found out. But he also knows that there's some length of time before they're going to figure this out. And so he's motivated to make sure that their detection abilities are muted. So if he can keep them in the dark for a while, he's more likely to get laid by the six or the seven. And if he does, there's some significant statistical chance that he will wind up a father with better genes than he gave. And so this is, in fact, the deep game that's going on in nature. And so our young guy is just playing the same game that every walrus plays. He's just playing it slightly different with the human cards instead of the walrus cards. So whenever you see some animal in nature sort of puff up as it struts in front of a female, or watch the peacock feathers. The peacocks are just going about their business, and then a female walks by, peahen walks by, and then boom, those are the human equivalent of peacock feathers. And so, and this is what's going to happen. So this guy is now puffed up, looking fancier than he really is, and in hoping to sell these genes to some buyer who's about to get duped. Now, so he's motivated to keep him in the dark, and this is what gets critical. So let's suppose there's a hunt four weeks later. So there's going to be another big hunt. It will be very smart of this guy to see to it that he does not go on the next hunt. So it will be strategically advantageous if he sprains his ankle one day before the next hunt, or otherwise has something that he has to do that keeps him from doing there, because maybe he can delay this for another 30 days and take another few shots, if you will, at the genes. So this is what he is designed to do, is to figure out how to delay and defer and to fiddle around, essentially to avoid the vetting. And this is precisely what is going to happen to every child who's their loving adult parent tells them that they're brilliant, that they're fantastic, that they're greatly talented, etc. Any over-the-top praise will result in that child knowing that they have more status than they deserve in the mind of that parent. And so this dynamic doesn't just happen in the mating arena. It happens in any arena of human relations where there are resources on the other side of the table that we're trying to trade for or to mine. And so in this case, the child would like to continue to be a high priority for the parent's resources. And so they want the parent's love, affection, support, and caring and concern. And so the parent has basically said, I think that you are a 99th percentile specimen, effectively. They're going to say you're a straight-A student. And the kid knows that the kid is not, quote, a straight-A student. The kid knows that, in fact, they're a very good student that once got straight A's, but most of the time does not. And so when the parent goes over the top and heaps too much praise on the child, then what happens is the child is in exactly the same situation as our young man is in the Stone Age, where they have more credit than they deserve. And they are designed by nature to smoke out these dynamics and realize that the only way to keep that excess status is to avoid the hunt. And in this case, they have to avoid the observation of their real abilities in school. So in this case, the real abilities in school would be, what are your grades if you try really hard? Well, if the child now realizes, I cannot do this, I have to make sure that I do not try really hard and therefore get whatever grades that I have coming to me at the end of such a process. Instead, what I'm going to want to do is sprain my ankle. So what the kid does is, a lot of times they'll quit. Okay, it is the brilliant move to actually quit, become a flake, not want to do their homework, drag around the house, play their video games, and otherwise disengage. Can be very upset, and there can be arguments and bitter recriminations, and then rewards offered for if the child will just get on track, and then the well-meaning but misguided parent, who incidentally in this case is status seeking for themselves, because what they are trying to do is that they are trying to grandstand to the village how great the genes are in their children, and therefore either one of two things. They're either trying to aid and abet that child's ability to mate advantageously in the future, or more likely, they are trying to increase their own status and cachet in the mating community by demonstrating what fantastic genes they have brought forth into the world, and therefore they could do the same for you, okay? So the parents have genetic agendas that they're completely unconscious of, but sometimes those agendas are not even directed at the child per se and the child's personal interests. Sometimes they're directed at the parent's interests, completely independent of the child, and sometimes the kids can sniff this too, and it's a very unpleasant little dynamic inside the child's mind as they're staring into the seemingly well-meaning but misguided parents, and they definitely have a conflict of interest. The child wants the parents' authentic regard for who it is that they are, and the parents are instead trying to push and shove that child into being 10 or 15 or 20% fancier than the child really is, and you put the child in the trap where it is very difficult for them to simply go forth and do their very best work. So instead what they do is they self-sabotage. And this is the root of human self-destructive behavior is right here, where it's actually winds up being in the child's best interest to kick over the table and flunk out. Because if they kick over the table and flunk out, then as the parent in their frustration is climbing the walls, trying to figure out why the child is doing this, the parent keeps saying, "But you're so brilliant, but you're so brilliant, but you're so brilliant." As long as the parent says, gives them that kind of heavy-handed positive feedback and encouragement, the child knows they still have the status, okay, and they have not yet lost it. And so it's putting them in a permanent state of not having to ever go out on the hunt and be vetted. And so therefore, it maintains an indefinite perpetual cycle of self-destructive behavior.
So let's say you are now the child.
Yeah.
Or in essence, I guess, well, let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
This is a parent-child relationship where clearly right. they're forced to interact with each other in most normal situations. And so if a child is going through this, they can't exactly just pick up and leave.
Right.
But does this situation also happen in outside life, say at work or with friends or I guess in adult life as well?
Sure. Happens all over the place. It happens between adult children and adult parents. Expectations can get too high and the adult children can feel like they are not meeting parental expectations at that level. And they can be very frustrated and they can actually feel like sabotaging themselves as a result. It can happen in actually friendships. There are friendships where sometimes this is actually a problem. A lot of times, let's suppose someone is struggling in an arena, mating arena, job arena, and they have a friend or some other interpersonal arena, and they have a friend that is a part of the support system, and even a good, well-meaning friend will say things like, "Well, you're just beautiful just as you are, and you're great, and you know he should love you," blah, 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 okay? So what the friend does is actually give falsely positive feedback to what the person's real situation is. And this can put them in the same trap, okay? It can put them, I actually discovered this clinically more than 20 years ago. I had a fascinating event, and when it ended, I looked out the door, and I sat in my office for about 15 minutes afterwards trying to figure out what had happened. Here's what took place. I was a psychologist for the criminal justice system in Dallas, Texas, and one of the things that I did was that I saw people that were on either felony or misdemeanor probation or parole. And so I had a guy that was sent to me by the probation system, and they told me that he was in deep trouble with the judge because he hadn't paid any of his probation fees and he didn't have a job. And if he did not get himself a job pretty soon and start paying the $25 a month fees, he might find himself with a 5-year sentence in the state penitentiary, which seemed to be a tragedy because he was otherwise behaving himself. And so he came in to me, and I sat down, and I looked at his record, and it was not a particularly bad criminal record, and he had done construction work in Texas. This was in the late 80s and early 90s. And he had, but he was out of work, and it was kind of a tough economy. It wasn't a horrible economy. It had gone crash down, and then it was coming back up. But it was just starting to function halfway decently, not like the boom of the mid-80s in Dallas at that time. And so I asked him, you know, what was going on and how was he getting by, and I don't remember to this day how he was even surviving. But he did not have a job and didn't have probation fees. And I said, listen, you know, you're going to need to get something because you're going to need to pay these probation fees. And he said, well, I said, you know, what have you done for a living? And he was a carpenter. And I said, huh? And I said, well, you know, you're going to need to get work because you're going to need to get these probation fees because the judge is going to come down on you. I happen to know this judge, and this judge is going to be bad news. He's not going to let this slide. And the man said, well, I won't work for less than $50,000 a year. And time, I was not making $50,000 a year as a young psychologist. And so I considered this to be an offensive, overly aggressive, ridiculous position. And I also knew the carpenters were in a bit of a tight spot in Dallas at that time because they'd been through a heck of a recession. And I said, well, you know, that's not going to happen. You know, you're going to have to get realistic. And he says, well, I made this and that. And he gave me his resume for a few minutes about all the projects he'd worked on and how much money he'd made, et cetera. And he had this arrogant swagger. And this is a guy without a job, without his probation fees, facing the state pen. And it just looked to me like somebody needed to be hit on the head. And so I did. I hit him on the head, but I did it professionally and cordially, but firmly. And I said, listen, the probation officer that supervises your case does not make $50,000. The court supervisor, who is in fact in charge of the probation officers, all of them in that court, does not make $50,000. The psychologist that is talking to you does not make $50,000. The fact that you believe that you should be making $50,000 and you're not going to work for less than that just isn't making sense lined up with the current realities. And I said, now, it turns out I know something about the construction situation because I talked to a lot of construction guys in here. And it isn't like it used to be, but it's not as bad as it was a couple of years ago. I said, now, I believe that you can actually probably make $25,000 a year right now, and you're actually going to be able to get work. Now, at that time, that sounds like a pitiful amount of money today for us, Nate, but the truth is in Dallas in 1992, 25 years ago, that would have gotten you a really nice apartment and a good car, and you could live very well. It would be the equivalent of $50,000 or $60,000 a year today in Texas. So it was a pretty good living. There's no reason to be unhappy about that. And I said, listen, for that kind of money, you would get yourself a nice car, nice place to live, spending money. I said, there's nothing wrong with this. And he said, no, I'm not going to work for anything less than 50. I made 50,000. I heard this. And then I just talked to him a little longer, and I was kind of disgusted. And then something very interesting happened. This is all transpiring within about 15 minutes. He says, do you really think I could get a job for $25,000? And instantly, my irritation with him went to zero. And I said to him, you know, I'm not sure that you can, but I think you might. And I said, guys that are starting to hustle are starting to get work like this. And I believe that if you're skilled and you have all the experience that you said you've had, I believe there's a very good chance that you could. That guy left all fired up about going to look for work. And I sat in that office, and I couldn't figure out what had happened. And I don't know to this day when I figured it out. I was cogitating on this for a while. And I realized that there was this trap, that for some reason he had his, quote, ego in this, that his ego had told him that he deserved this highfalutin thing. But he was actually defending his ego against the great fear that he couldn't even achieve something less than this. And so this is what I come to term the ego trap, that when expectations get too high, you'll see people put the brakes on and they won't even try. He had not even been looking for a job because he was terrified that if he looked for one, he wouldn't even be able to find one. And so as soon as I got the expectations down to a reasonable level where he started to believe he might be able to achieve it, he was suddenly turned his motivation forward, and he was ready to really try. And since that time, I have found that whenever I see a child, for example, that's coming in that is, quote, flunking out, that was previously doing better in school, this is the problem. That the expectations, that the parent is inevitably screaming to me that they're a brilliant child and they can't figure out what is happening with their Johnny. And when I explain to the parents what's going on and I get Johnny quietly in a room and I get the expectations down, and I tell the child that, you know, I actually think that your parents are out of line and that they don't know what's going on at your school and that you cannot get straight A's anymore because that means that your parents would have to do your homework because that's all the other parents are doing the other homeworks for the other kids. And that, in fact, what I think that you can get is, mostly B's and a couple C's. And that if you'll just do that, we'll give you everything that your parents have promised you if you get really good grades. And when I do that, the kids laugh at me, and they're excited, and they can't wait to show not only clean the table with what it is that they're going to get for all these things, Pokemon or, you know, Boy Scout trip, whatever it is that they want. They're going to get everything that they want. But they also are going to sail past my expectations. There is no feeling in the world like beating expectations. And there's no worse feeling in the world feeling like you cannot live up to them. And so this is you do not want to trap somebody's ego by high expectations. And this is typical, so I'm not really coming down on parents here. This is typical of both parents and friends, that they can easily be overly encouraging, over-positive, thinking that you are doing a good thing and a good deed, and you're being a good person for the little person on the other side, but you are not, actually. Better to be straight and direct, and if anything at all, when you've got somebody in the mess like that, to undersell it a little bit. And that's how we do it.
That's very, very interesting, because it goes contrary to all the Hollywood movies that I've seen, and it goes contrary to all the motivational speakers and talks and things like that. So it's the question I have, though, is, let's say you're the person who's being ego trapped, or someone who's getting expectations placed on them. How do you get out of that trap without telling somebody else how to live their life and how to talk to you, basically?
Right. You know, this can be difficult, how to get out of it. So I'll actually explain the process. I mean, is to there's more than one piece of the process, but one of the processes is that once we understand that this trap exists, that we actually inform that individual that we're going to take the expectations down. But that's actually not our expectations for whatever this thing is. So let's suppose that you're a poet and you like poetry and you're pretty good at it. And you start talking about how you're going to write a book of poetry, and you've got some overly eager best friend that, you know, believes that your poems are going to, you know, you're going to really sell well. Okay? Well, and you start to feel that creepy feeling of the ego trap, that you're not sure you're going to be able to live up to those expectations. And so you start to feel demotivated. By the way, if we hear anybody listen to this, this is what causes, quote, writer's block. Okay, that's what this is. This isn't some mysterious affliction of writers. This is the affliction of the ages. This is what happens whenever expectations get too high. The motivational system says the best thing to do is do nothing. Don't go on that hunt. Okay? If they believe you're so great, don't go on the hunt and prove them wrong. If you're known in your little social circle as somebody that can write, and you've told people that you're going to write something, then the problem is that you now got the expectations too high. And now you face writer's block, as you're supposed to sit down and brilliant things are supposed to come out of you, and you got this creepy feeling that they're not going to come out of you because it's not that simple. Yet they would think it would be that simple because of this wonderful talent that you have. So if you're the poet that's going to, you know, publish this little book of poems, and your friends are saying, oh my goodness, you know, you're going to be, it's going to be so great. It's like, and you feel that creepy feeling and you feel yourself procrastinating and delaying. What that's about is the ego trap trying to defend your status from somebody who's set the bar too high. So what we need to do is we need to set the bar lower. And the notion here is to consciously and firmly say, you know, I'm going to write some poems and let's hope that they're not all terrible. Okay? And so, you know, they can't all be bad. We go exactly the opposite direction. Okay? So if you're a writer and you're going to write a novel, it's like, oh, I'm sure you'll do great. It's like, well, let's hope I don't do terrible. Okay? I'm hoping for lousy. That would be good. So we turn this thing around. Okay? And the truth of the matter is that what we really have to do to get out of the ego traps is we have to dare to be lousy. And if we essentially broadcast that the whole notion here is that, you know what? I'm planning on going out there, and it's going to be lousy, but I'll learn something. And, you know, that's what the process is for. That's what life's for, is for learning. And so we're going to give this thing a try, see what happens, probably be lousy, maybe a little better than lousy, who knows, maybe a little worse. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn something. And so that we keep the what we're trying to do here, Nate, is actually we're trying to borrow a very important philosophical principle from the Buddhists. So, you know, there's I am not personally a Buddhist, and I'm not that well versed in all different sort of religious and spiritual traditions, but I am aware of something, and that is many diverse religious and spiritual traditions have a lot of wisdom in there, but they can't really articulate what the wisdom is. There's a reason why this information and these ideas have found ways to be passed down through the ages, because they've hit little tones inside of human nature that resonate. And the Buddhist notion of not being attached to something is essentially this. So let's not get attached to what I call the outcome of what it is that we're doing. So if we're going to write a book of poetry, we're not going to get attached to the outcome that the poetry is going to be any good. We're not going to get attached to the outcome that anybody's going to like it, that anybody's going to be impressed. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be essentially trying to get lost in the process. But we want to essentially try to not have our mind searching so hard as to the grand outcome of what's going to come of this, but instead just get lost in the process with the notion that, you know, as we do this, we're going to learn something, and that we don't have high expectations for the level of greatness or grandeur that is going to come from this, but instead trying to do is we're trying to learn and grow and just see what happens and see if we can enjoy the process. And that's what we want to do with everything, if we can.
Now, so how does that play into, I mean, last week we talked about self-esteem and how it's actually a beneficial thing to, or it's actually a very strange thing if people are not caring what anybody else thinks. When I hear people talk about motivation, a common theme is, well, you have to stop caring so much about what other people think and just do it. And it seems like there's a disconnect between, like, they've got the right idea in terms of get lost in the process, but they've got that disconnect of, well, just don't care what anybody thinks.
Right. Now, the truth is that the Buddhist dream cannot be realized. So, and this is what you're talking about. So when people say, don't care what anybody else thinks, the entire point to the way your organization of your architecture of your mind is all about what other people think. You're all about trying to impress the opposite sex, if that happens to be your sexual orientation. You're all about trying to impress people to trade in the marketplace with you, and you're out to impress people to be your friends. And when I say impress, I don't mean in some tacky way. We're out to show them what we have to exchange with them, value for value. And so we cannot be, a Buddhist doesn't live on the mountainside by himself, feed himself, mate with himself, and not and ensure himself against disaster by not having any friends. That is not how it is. Human beings are not a solitary, isolated animal. Wolverines are. There's one wolverine per 50,000 acres. They don't make friends. They don't trade. There is nothing friendly about a wolverine in its life. But a human being is an interconnected, highly hypersocial species. And as a result, we care a great deal about what other people think because we have to. Now, we don't have to care about what everybody thinks all the time. We have to think. We have to be thinking about what some people think about us as we try to show them what we have to trade with them. However, there is a difference between learning and growing and doing our best and understanding that this is connected to us being able to display and advertise for people that we would want to win as mates, friends, and trading partners. In other words, to do the job authentically and genuinely, and I wouldn't even say to the best of our ability, because it isn't your responsibility to squeeze every ounce out of your potential. That is not the point. But the point is to do well and to be focused on doing a job well as opposed to doing a job that they will think it's cool. Okay, it's almost like, you know, there's a difference when you're cleaning your house, potentially for yourself, and you clean behind the corners and you're determined to actually do a really good job because you yourself want it really clean, versus the neighbors are happen to be coming over and you kind of need to do a surface clean and hope they don't look behind the corners. So much of human life is about doing it for the neighbors quickly to look as good as possible, shortcutting our way. That, you know, we're going to do some of that, but the most authentic esteem process is going to be when we don't worry too much about what the score is, about what they are thinking. We know that it is ultimately, quote, for them, but we want to actually do it very well so that our own internal self is watching the process and respecting ourselves for our process. And in doing so, the notion is we get lost in the process as we move towards good outcomes. And the final concept is essentially that whatever the outcome is the outcome. We let the market decide the outcome. And what this, if we can get to this Buddhist-like state in with respect to many of our things, then what happens is this is what I call a position of power. Position of power is when we are not desperate for a specific outcome of what the world says about us. Instead, what we are is we will take whatever outcome comes because it will be a fair and reasonable outcome with respect to what it is that we have earned. And we will trust that at any given go-around, we may get less than we earn, and in some go-around, may get more than we earn. But in the final analysis, whatever it is that we get from the marketplace will be a fairly decent facsimile about what we've earned, so that the big thing we need to be paying attention to is earning it by doing things in the right way. And that's why we want a kid. That's why it's not a good thing for parents to be doing their kids' homework, you know, writing their essays for them, you know, et cetera. Forget it. You let that kid earn it. They're on their own. And whatever grades they get are the grades they get, okay? And the pride should be that they got it themselves, they got it in the right way, and we didn't set the expectations too high for them, so whatever they get, they walk away with it with pride. And that's what we want.
Yeah, a very, very close teacher of mine growing up, he was mostly concerned. He said, "I don't care about your results. I care that you studied or that you trained or that you worked on the process." So his expectation was always, did you train or did you study? I don't care what grade you got. Did you study enough hours? Is this something similar? Did he have something unique?
No, he is excellent. That is exactly what I'm talking about. This concept is not new. I think some of the bells and whistles that some of my thinking brings to it is that we can talk high concept in psychology about some of the sophisticated little nuances of the process in a way that have never been talked about before, because we understand human neuroscience and neuroarchitecture in a way that we never have. However, the lessons are timeless, and all of the great teachers and the great coaches of the world know this. that you do not heap praise on people, you do not set expectations high, that in fact what you do is you set expectations for effort, that you don't set expectations for other things, not for outcome. And so in that same way as a parent, I would set expectations for effort that you know, you're going to do X amount of homework, and if it's ridiculous or something, then we're going to set the bar for how much you're going to do at what we all think is reasonable, and then you're going to do it. And whatever the outcome is of those efforts, that's fine. But we're going to put in that effort so that your internal self knows that you put in that effort, that you didn't shortcut and you didn't do a sloppy job, and whatever the outcome is the outcome, and we can live with that.
Very interesting. I want to play a clip for you and just get your reaction to it. This is a clip from the movie Rocky, and he has a bit of a falling out with his son. So he talks to him, and just understanding a little bit about what you're telling me, it seems like he's putting his son in the ego trap. So I want to see what you think about this. The clip's about 2 minutes long, but I'm going to play the first 30 seconds and then get a reaction, and we'll finish the clip.
Good. Yeah.
You ain't going to believe this. Well, you used to fit right here. I'd hold you up to say to your mother, this kid's going to be the best kid in the world. This kid's going to be somebody better than anybody ever knew. And you grew up good and wonderful. It was great just watching. Every day was like a privilege. Then the time come for you to be your own man, to take on the world, and you did. But somewhere along the line, you changed.
So that's the clip right there. What do you think?
Yes, beautiful. That's a beautiful example of the ego trap. And so this kid who grew up Rocky Balboa's, this must have been the movie Rocky Balboa. Mm-hmm. And so this kid obviously grew up under the enormous specter of this father who's this world-famous athlete. And now dad is heaping seemingly wonderful, warm, loving praise on him. But now he's signaling that the kid changed and disappointed him. And of course, when I watched that movie years ago, that there was no question. That's a big bad ego trap, a tremendously difficult situation for that kid to live under. Yeah, let's go ahead. Let's hear more.
It was very good. Watching every day was like a privilege. Then the time come for you to be your own man and take on the world, and you did. But somewhere along the line, you changed. You stopped being you. You let people stick a finger in your face and tell you you're no good. And when things got hard, you started looking for something to blame, like a big shadow. Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits and not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
Talk about a big ego trap, huh?
Big ego trap. And actually, a very realistically acted one, that a super high-achieving father, like a Rocky, who did have a very rough life and had tremendous challenges and then overcomes those challenges, and he looks at his son, who had it so much easier, and that the bar wasn't even as high as it had ever been for Rocky. And yet his son blaming other people for his failures and basically shying away and not toughing it out. And yet what do we hear? We hear the father's frustration of saying, essentially, when parents get frustrated with their kids not achieving, with the encouragement they give, they turn up the volume higher. And you're mm-hmm. hearing a very authentic process. That's the parents only know one gear. And when I tell parents we go the other way, some of them are terrified. They think the kids are going to just quit and not do anything and become, you reach for the stars and then at least you'll get the moon. and this is a very big mistake. And so, yeah, this is that's a beautifully acted portrayal of how to not do it. And I'm glad you found it, Nate. That's a great example.
How would somebody listening know that they are in an ego trap?
You know that you're in the ego trap when you feel self-destructive, bitter, unmotivated, that you keep procrastinating, that you just feel a pressure, that you don't feel a joy of the new day at whatever goal it is that you need to reach to reach a new level of happiness and satisfaction, that you aren't excited about engaging in it and to try to get better. That in fact, you're in a defensive position where you're trying to not look bad and you're trying to avoid. If that's where you are, this is the thing to listen to and go to my website, Esteem Dynamics. I talk about this issue in detail. And this is what people need to focus on. You can get out of this trap. And when you do, life gets a lot better very fast.
Are there any take-home tips that you would recommend for people who are trying to get out of the ego trap? Maybe something they can do or consider?
There's a lot. I mean, you might want to look at a book called Wooden, which is a story of the teachings of John Wooden, great basketball coach at UCLA. It's called A Lifetime of Reflections on and Off the Court. And even if you're not a basketball fan or a sports fan, these are some timeless insights into human nature. Wooden was the master at keeping his young men out of the ego trap despite phenomenal expectations of being UCLA basketball players. And he was able to keep them focused on the process and not the outcome. And so some of his ways of looking at life and some of his mantras can be very useful tools as a person tries to move away from that kind of a position of worrying about the outcome and worrying about what other people think into a more internal-driven position where it's about whether or not I am learning and growing and willing to stumble, but learning to essentially focus on the process and the pride that comes from doing that.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. This is great information. In fact, I just read an article saying that they did functional MRI tests on people and found out that if you want to be happy, lower your expectations, which is in fact exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dr. Lyle. We'd love to have you back on. We can talk about some other topics here.
I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.